Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm film critic April Wolf. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, maybe one that influenced their own work. Today, I'm very excited to have writer-director Daisy von Schuller-Mayer with me.
Hi.
Hi. Please let me give you an introduction to Daisy and her work. In 1995, Daisy made her feature directorial debut at the Sundance Film Festival with her critically acclaimed cult classic Party Girl, which simultaneously launched Parker Posey's career. Co-written by von Schuller-Mayer, the film's success led to a Fox TV series, which I haven't seen and I'm dying to get my hands on those episodes.
It's No, you're not.
Well, I mean, it's April. Like it's Swoozie Kurtz. And
Christine Taylor.
Christine Taylor and Swoozie Kurtz. Yeah, I was very interested in that.
Then they're wonderful, but it's not a good show.
Oh, damn it. Damn it. Next, after that, though, she adapted and directed the classic children's book Madeline into a Columbia Pictures film starring Oscar winner Frances McDormand. You may have heard of her. Potentially. She followed this with the Bollywood-influenced comedy The Guru, starring Heather Graham and Marissa Tomei for working title films. Her last film was an adaptation of Neil LaBute's play Some Girls, starring Adam Brody, Emily Watson, Zoe Kazan, and Kristen Bell, which follows a man who's revisiting all of his exes before his wedding day. As a television director, von Schuller-Mayer has worked in both hour-long drama series and half-hour comedy for network, cable, and streaming services, including ABC, NBC, CBS, AMC, Showtime. Okay, all of them. The shows she's worked on include Get Shorty, that's the most recent, and there's Rave Donovan, Halt and Catch Fire, Bosch, The Walking Dead, Fear the Walking Dead, Reverie, For the People, Chicago Med, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, House of Lies, Mozart in the Jungle, The Last Tycoon, Good Girls Revolt, a lot of cult stuff in here, About a Boy, Orange is the New Black, Shameless, Nurse Jackie, Shut Eye, and Mad Men. And in her free time, she mentors for the AFI Directing Workshop for Women and presumably spends some waking moments with her husband, composer David Carbonara, and their two daughters in Los Angeles. So that's the rundown on Daisy. It's a pretty great life.
I'm tired listening to that. I should take a vacation.
It's interesting that you say that you're tired, and we've got this very busy director here with us because the movie that you chose to talk about today is about a very tired and busy director. It is called All That Jazz. Can you tell me a little bit about why that was the movie that you wanted to pick about today to talk about that maybe influenced your work? Why is it one of your fave genre films?
It's funny. You could consider it a fantasy. I've always considered it a musical, but I love the film because it is so incredibly personal and intimate about Bob Fosse and his life, and at the same time so insanely theatrical and bold in the filmmaking. And I guess I grew up in New York City, and I'm third generation show business, both sides. Mm-hmm. So to have that depiction of theatricality brought into something that could also be grounded and personal, it just, to me, blows my mind every time I see it. Right. I love the movie.
And your mother was a pretty
My mom did over 100 plays in New York City, and then I put her in Party Girl. She was never a huge film person. She has a little cameo in Network. Sasha von Schuller is her name. And so that obsessive perfectionist, the theater is everything, the theater is above all, and then that, for me, translated into film as well. It's a state of being, and there's only a couple of films that I feel really capture it. I was thinking about Birdman is another one that people always talk about the filmmaking style in that. But for me, the characterization of that man and what show business means to him is similar to the Joe Gideon character. But, stylistically, I've always been one of those directors more in the vein of a Jonathan Demme who I just, I want to do whatever's right for the material. And Bob Fosse does whatever's right for the scene. So if you look at the actual the camera work, you go from these kind of documentary opening sequence with the chorus line folks that really feels like hidden camera and long lenses and, we're right there with them to one of the craziest 12-minute fantasy sequences that ends the film. And somehow it doesn't seem crazy that you're jumping style, that you're jumping because the writing is in sync with it. So I always feel like my job with the camera and lighting and everything else is just to follow the writing and see where it takes you. And with Bob Fosse, he'll just take you anywhere. You know, it doesn't have to be all in this, like, oh, it's mumblecore, or, oh, it's this. It's like Fosse will just do anything that that scene in that moment demands. And then there's the dance, which is just great.
Yeah.
I can't do, but I love to see on film.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of those things where it does marry an almost documentary style with that fantasy that you're talking about. Because when it goes fantasy, it goes fantasy. Yeah. There is no going back. Like, it is a bonanza of fantasy. And I, you know, it's one of my favorite films as well. So I'm glad that we get to talk about it. But for those of you who haven't seen All That Jazz, today's episode will give you some spoilers, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. My motto, as always, is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to pause and watch All That Jazz right now, I highly encourage you to do so, because this is going to be a very interesting discussion. So you're back, and I'm going to introduce All That Jazz. Written by Robert Allen Arthur and Bob Fosse and directed by Fosse for release in 1979, All That Jazz is an auto-fiction fantasy musical starring Roy Scheider as Joe Gideon, the alter ego of Fosse. We meet Joe first as he is speaking to Lady Death Angelique, played by Jessica Lange, and then second as Joe's rehearsing hundreds of hopefuls for a new musical. He narrows the cast down to about 10 men and women, whom we then watch learn Gideon's choreography, intercut with this, we see the self-deprecating director live a life of excess. In one of the film's many montages, Gideon starts his day with Alka-Seltzer, Dexedrine, and shower, and a mantra he delivers into the mirror. It's showtime, folks. We then see Gideon interacting with his ex, Audrey, a dancer whom he clearly still respects and admires and collaborates with, though he cheated on her pretty much any chance he got, and very open about it. Both of them are. One of his mistresses is Kate, with whom he reluctantly decides to commit to living. But everyone knows the drill. Joe's attention can't be kept for very long. The only person who doesn't want something more from Joe, however, is Angelique, who's just amused by his excesses because they only bring him closer to her grasp. When Joe has a heart attack, the doctors tell him to slow down, but he just can't. After a second heart attack, Joe goes into a trance-like state, and a series of dance numbers depict all the things he will lose if he dies, all the love he had and wasted. But in the end, death is just another glorious dance number with Joe as the star. So,
that's a tough one. Good job.
Thank you. I know. When I was just
it's not a plot that rolls off the tongue.
What does happen in this?
Yeah.
It's funny rewatching it for that. I was like, I have to pay attention to plot now.
Right.
It's one of those movies where it is difficult to describe. I have to ask, you know, what is your favorite part of this film?
I think it's the editing, the juxtaposition of the jumping back in his brain between what's going on with the Angel of Death, who he's having a conversation with, and then whether it's these very simple naturalistic scenes, like that happens throughout the whole movie, but it's that. One of the things that really strikes me is what can you do in film that you can't do in theater, that you can't do on television? You know, what is it that's exclusive to film? And to me, that stylistic, being able to be inside somebody's brain and inhabit their world, that's what got me.
Yeah. I mean, I like to think of film as opposed to television. Film to me seems more like a poem.
Mm-hmm.
And when it fulfills that kind of poem-like state where it sits by itself and it's a kind of conundrum and puzzle that will have loose ends, you know, that's the kind of thing that I enjoy in film. And, of course, All That Jazz fulfills so much of that.
And you could never – there's never a second episode.
Yeah.
You know,
this is it.
The final image of the film, you're not going back.
No, they go for broke. And that's, you know, that's another thing that I enjoy with film. It's just like it should be everything. Do not hold it back. Put everything you have into this movie.
And tonally, it does something, which it has been in other films, but there is a comedy showbiz / painful desperation tone that you're walking, this tightrope. And I was mentioning before, it reminds me of Birdman, but there's in Singing in the Rain, Donald O'Connor has that make him laugh routine.
Oh, yeah.
And it's funny, funny, funny. And then as it gets anxious and anxious and anxious, the desperation to make him laugh at the end, the camera goes up and it's this overhead shot of him. And it's so almost chilling.
Yeah.
And I feel like Bob Fosse must have thought of that when he was making this film. I don't know.
But. No, I mean, absolutely. I mean, he was obviously a student of film, a student of theater.
And not dance just, on film,
exactly,
obviously.
Exactly, exactly. I want to getting, you know, you mentioned the editing first, and I think that that's a really good place for us to start this conversation, because All That Jazz actually won the Academy Award for its editing that year. But the style of film was already written and baked into the script, because Fosse and his editor, Alan Heim, essentially developed that fragmented style to cover up Dustin Hoffman's lackluster performance in Lenny, which is a point of contention between all of them, where Dustin Hoffman is just like, oh, you ruined my performance. Right. And they were like, actually, we got you an award for it. And Fosse decided to lean into that kind of fragmented style even further and just really fuck up the narrative from the get-go. So I admire a writer that can write that specific of an edit, because he was writing for the edit. And I love reading that script, because it's a lesson in how to move from place to place and to have that kind of freedom of, you know, envision to understand exactly how it's going to be written. It's one of those things where, you know, we always talk about there are three different kinds of the three different movies, you know, the one that's written, the one that's shot, the one that's edited, right? Old adage.
The one that's abandoned.
Exactly, right? And so it's very interesting to me that the longer that Fosse worked, the closer that the first movie is to the last movie. You know, the first the written page is closer to the edit. And I was wondering, you know, is that something that you do if you're working on a...
Sure. I mean, going back... Well, first of all, fun factoid. Alan Heim, the wonderful editor who I've actually had the honor of meeting, who won the Oscar for All That Jazz, is in the film playing the editor of the movie within the movie. And the movie has so many movies within the movie that it's mind-blowing, including 10 years after the movie comes out, Bob Fosse dies of a heart attack, quite similar to his alter ego on the screen. But absolutely, the editing, especially with dance, I feel like, and with musical numbers, there's a great history. He does it in Cabaret, but in Party Girl, which my tour de force first film, but we actually watched this sequence, Douglas Sirk from Written on the Wind, where there's this teenage girl and she's dancing in her bedroom as her, you know, aging grandfather has a heart attack on the stairway, and it gets really manic, the cutting in between the two. And so our big vision was to rip that off, which I always encourage filmmakers, just, you know, look at what you like and rip it off. It will never be a ripoff. Like, there's nobody who looks at Parker Posey in the stairwell at the end of Party Girl cutting to weird images of a belly dancer and says, I bet she ripped off that Douglas Sirk movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, yeah.
It's nowhere close. But it was wanting the mania of like a really free sexual kind of like dance out there, which you get in the Sirk movie and which you get all over Bob Fosse, and then juxtaposing that against some kind of stakes or some kind of heightened thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I have done that, like even in the TV world. I do. There was an opening moment in Halt and Catch Fire where Toby Huss had to sing a Frank Sinatra number. And I was like, guys, you open with this really sedate scene of the computers not working. And then the next scene is the performance. I said, couldn't we intercut those and make that more of a thing? And so we did do it on the page, because if you don't do it on the page, oh, you run into music editing problems. You run into, I don't know. I feel like your transitions filmically in and out of sequences, if you don't know you're going to cut there, they're just going to be less elegant, or at least less elegant from my point of view, because maybe a better director could get all the footage perfectly and have all those options. But I need to know that I'm going to go from A to B.
Well, I think, you know, it seemed, you know, Fosse also decided he wanted to know.
Right, right.
Because Lenny was a mistake, you know. It was like a really beautiful mistake where they, you know, kind of borrowed from the montage editing of like the Soviet era or whatever, and like went back to this, you know, weird juxtaposition thing that they were doing.
Well, and because he does it with the dialogue, it makes it much easier visually to go from sort of a naturalistic scene where he's talking to his girlfriend, and then you cut to Jessica Lange. Mm-hmm. I was like, Angela Lang. Jessica
I know,
Lange.
Right?
But you cut to Jessica Lange, and she says, like, have you ever said I love you? And he's like, only to get what I want, or only to get laid, or something. And then you cut to him saying it to the girl. You know, those kind of, like, that helps us get in and out of the different visual spaces that the script is leading us and making the way make sense.
It's one of those, I think it's really interesting, too, that, you know, because Lenny's editing style was a mistake, as we said, it's interesting that when they got into the room, Bob Fosse actually wanted to break up the narrative and the scenes that they shot of Angelique more, you know, like the kind of death scenes.
Right.
But they didn't lend themselves to that kind of editing because they had already shot it with that editing in the script. And so he got frustrated that he couldn't break them down further.
Right. And that makes sense because they're not shot to be broken up further. I mean, a performance, you got three cameras going and you can jump around and jump around the performance. But those are very languid, kind of seductive scenes as she tries to seduce him and you know, to her side, i.e. dying.
i.e. dying, yes. Yeah. That's the fantasy portion of that. And one of the things I think is very fascinating with the Angelique scenes, too, is that Bob Fosse chose to shoot all of those scenes after the movie was shot. So they shot the main A narrative and then went into, you know, a studio somewhere in upstate New York. And they, you know, they set up the thing with Jessica Lange and Roy Scheider. Mm-hmm. And that's where they set those, because apparently Bob Fosse wanted to have the option of getting further into philosophical conversations or getting into further into conversations about his life, you know, kind of filling in holes that they had from the assembly of the main A narrative.
I just hearing you say that, the one, I'm really happy to be working in TV, and I love TV, and I think TV has the best writers out there right now.
Yeah.
But when you hear a story like that, you realize what we lose when we make things on a schedule. We lose that kind of an artist being able to dig deep into their work and take time and look at the work and go back to it. Like Jackson Pollock didn't just do all the lines at once. Like, they take time. There's process. And often when I'm working on a television show, somebody says, well, your vision was, and I say, stop right there. That's my vision is my first idea because you guys gave me the script this morning, you know, or I read it on the plane. I'm here now on a scout. Yes, I said I'd like to have an orange door, but now that I see the yellow door, like, that's better. And, you know, we're catching our vision up to our process, like, or our process up to our vision in a way that, he had the luxury to really know what he wanted and investigate it. And and it's so consistent. It's not like he's making things. He's not fixing it. He's evolving it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, there are different kinds of directors and writers out there. There are people who know exactly what they want when they get in. But the idea that someone can, you know, just decide that it's going to be okay to make the story better by screwing something up that they had before, you know, and you see that represented in the actual movie too, because when he's directing this cast in the is it Take Flight, I think the name of the song, like the big erotic number,
right? And they're all staring at him, and he just gets so upset because he has to leave the room, and he goes into his ex-wife, and he says, "I can't take them all looking at me. I got nothing. I'm done."
I can't go back to that room. I can't face those dancers. I'm stuck. They keep staring at me and nothing's coming out. Oh boy, the number's lousy.
My song? Lousy?
No, not the song. Me, the way I'm staging it. Maybe we should cut it.
Cut it? I think I'll leave.
Paul, sit right there. Go back to bar 17. And
you hear what I said? Nothing is coming.
Don't worry, Paul. He always says the same thing about every number in every show.
It's a great depiction of the creative process. I mean, that to me is like one of the things I love about the film, is it just really talks about how an artist works and how his perfectionism and also his standards being so high.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because I was thinking about, is it a musical? Because, OK, technically, like a musical, the musical numbers should move the plot forward.
Yeah.
And they do and they don't. I mean, when he shows his big, it's clearly a reference to Chicago, like his big seductive number, when it's done And it also shows how he uses lighting, which is really amazing. Like, he turns off the light even when he's just auditioning it for the producers and makes it so sexy.
Doesn't he use a flashlight?
Yeah, he uses a flashlight, and they're just blown away by the sex of it and kind of freaked out, which I'm sure they must have been with the original Chicago, which is still so sexy. So at the end of that number, plot-wise, the producers are now wary of him. So, yes, something has changed. But really, Joe Gideon hasn't changed at all. He was going to do his creative process and stick with it no matter – he's going to pick the dancers he wants regardless of whether there's a soprano. Like, every choice he makes is what's good for the show. And, you know, he doesn't lie to the girl that he's sleeping with. She says, could I be a movie star? He says, no. Like, there's something sacred about the work that is fixed, that, you know, that has to be great. And he will always do what's right for it. And I think that's a noble, you know, depiction and a noble goal for all of us to have. And it's very hard to have when you're working in a group process.
So we are going to take a quick break. But when we come back, I want to talk about the casting of Roy Scheider in this movie. Was not meant to be at first. So one quick break and we'll be right back.
All right. Tommy is about to books. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Hi, everybody. My name is Justin McElroy.
And I'm Sydney McElroy.
And together we're the hosts of Sawbones, a marital tour of misguided medicine. What does that mean for you, the podcast consumer? Well, it means that you're going to get a lot of stories about how we used to do weird stuff to people in order to try to fix them.
Do you know that we used to think diseases were caused by bad smells? And that we used to eat mummies for medicine?
That's super funny. I kind of like it.
Well, thanks. And we hope you'll kind of like our show, Sawbones, a marital tour of misguided medicine. It's available every Friday wherever fine podcasts are sold or at its beautiful picturesque home at
MaximumFun.org.
All right.
Yeah.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm here joined today by Daisy Von Schuller-Mayer. You have such a wonderful name. Just so much gravitas.
Yeah.
We are talking about All That Jazz, and specifically, we're going to talk about Roy Scheider. His casting was not at first what they wanted to do. I love the fact that Richard Dreyfuss was the first person who was set to play Joe Gideon. But apparently Dreyfuss went over to his Jaws co-star Roy Scheider's house for dinner one night and was just torn up about the film. He told Scheider that he didn't like Fosse and Fosse didn't like him. So he was desperately trying to find a way out of this part, which I think is hilarious. And the way that Fosse works, you know, obviously was notoriously intense, right? We were talking earlier about how he demands, you know, this kind of perfection or just at least trying, you know. So Roy Scheider apparently, after that conversation, requests to read the script because he and Fosse had the same agent. And Scheider decides he needs to have this part of Joe Gideon. So meanwhile, Fosse's like, I am not casting the guy from The French Connection. Everyone that he asked and talked about this was like, you're not casting the guy from The French Connection. So Scheider does a proverbial song and dance for Fosse, telling him about his 14 years in theater, playing every goofy role that was handed to him before he became the guy with, you know, the big Hollywood films. So that piqued Fosse's interest. And then Fosse tells Scheider that he'll consider him for the part if he comes over to his house every night for a week and reads through the script with him.
Oh, that's a great story. No, it's post-Jaws, too.
Yeah, post-Jaws, yeah.
So he's a big star. I mean, he's at the pinnacle of his... he's perfect. I mean, I can't imagine a better character meets actor.
But it's one of those things where if you haven't seen this movie and you've only seen kind of Scheider's big hits, like when I watched it with my husband, he hadn't seen it before. He was like, wait a second. Roy Scheider is this guy?
Right, right.
Like,
and
why?
How hot was he? Just forget about how hot he was and the thin man, which is kind of as men started bulking up and steroiding or whatever, we lost that, the slender man hottie, which I think he just crushes. He has such a great voice, and I often think with Sexuality, voice is huge. And there's something about a man who works with women intimately but isn't gay, mm-hmm. like Warren Beatty in Hairspray. Hairspray. That's a good mistake. Yeah, yeah. In Hair. it is a wonderful combination, I think, because he is such a love of and appreciator of women, and not in a offensive way at all, in my mind.
I absolutely agree. I think Scheider played this role the best that anyone could have. He is very sexy. I was watching this and I was just like, oh, I think that's my type.
Thin choreographer, like with skin tight, you know, black pants. Like, yeah, there's something about the whole. It's also that he does the dance and that he can commit to that and seems to have that kind of fluid. I mean, I don't know if he had a background in it or not, mm-hmm. but he's got me convinced when he's dancing with his daughter.
Break and jump. Ah.
It's just that I keep wondering, Dad.
Bend your knees. What is it you keep wondering?
Why don't you get married again?
Do a head roll. I don't get married again because I can't find anyone I dislike enough to inflict that kind of torture on.
Hey, why don't you marry Katie? She's terrific.
Keep rolling your head. Straighten your leg. Yeah, you're right. She's terrific. That's exactly why I don't want to marry her.
And if you said, I'm going to have the conversation while they're dancing, and I've done that, like I do that in Party Girl, I've done that in a number of things. It's a very theatrical choice. You know, are we really having a conversation while we're moving around? And he is such a grounded, authentic performer that you don't, it doesn't, I you know, Richard Dreyfuss, I don't know that I would have bought it.
No. I mean, Dreyfuss is great in his own yeah. right and the roles that he had. But this – and I have to say that that scene that you're talking about him dancing with his daughter, was the first one that they shot. Mm. And it was – Scheider had no background in dancing. He had 2.5 weeks to prepare. And then he – Fosse was like, I need you in this intimate scene where you have to act, talk, dance,
right.
and move around the space. And he was like –
Wow.
And so the thing is, though, that Fosse had so much confidence in him that he could do that scene that it made all of his nerves just kind of go away.
And then to conquer that scene, which is arguably one of the hardest right off the bat.
Yes.
Probably created a confidence in Scheider, which I think absolutely happens.
And that's one of the questions that a big question that I have for you today is, you know, talking about building confidence with your actor, and then also, you know, how your shooting list and can actually reinforce that. I mean, it seems would want to do like a hard one right off the bat, maybe, or just, you know, to build that confidence or to get people while they're fresh, but also you don't know what the tone is going to be like with them yet. I mean, what do you do?
I mean, absolutely the old adage, it's Citizen Kane in the morning and, you know, I can't remember, cornflakes commercial in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. Like, you just don't you're going to have more time and thoughtfulness. We're all fresher. We're all better in the morning. So I always try and look at the schedule and have a sort of flow to it where we're doing the meatier, more difficult stuff in the morning. I also try as much as I can to work in continuity because I think it's helpful for the actors to not jump in and because of some AD's scheduling or location issue, all of a sudden we're at the climax of the story and we haven't shot any of the other materials.
Tell people, AD is assistant director who does a lot of that, the scheduling and
there is an art to the schedule. There is a flow to it. There's just a real art to how, when we dive into which material and what comes first and what comes later. But I always try and meet with an actor if there's something like a sex scene or a performance or, you know, anything that we should just talk about how I'm going to film it and make them feel safe and make them feel comfortable. And honestly, I just talk to them. I mean, I think there's just something about there's sort of, and again, I've been working primarily in television, and there's kind of a, you know, at the monitor under a hat, sort of a way, you know, setting up the shots, and just a sort of inhumanity to how things are done for budgetary reasons, et cetera. So I just like to go up there and, you know, even if I'm giving a note that they say, oh, no, I don't want to do that. Oh, yeah, I got you. If that doesn't feel authentic, let's just do this, or what's organic over here, or whatever. Just trying to engage and say, I'm going to be part of the acting process with you. Not all TV directors are. I am. And I'm paying attention to what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And so just to be able to say, I love how you did such and such in that take. Let's get one where the ending, we tighten it up so she enters faster or something. You know, it can be completely technical, but it's an acknowledgement of, I understand that you have process. I understand that you're a human being. I understand. I'm shocked sometime at the way that actors are talked about, you know, in some of the jobs I do. Not most of them, but some. It's as if they're children or as if they're demeaned. Yes. And I have to say, like, I guess one of the things that I love about All That Jazz is in that opening scene, you get right from the get-go that no matter how flawed this guy is, no matter how addicted, no matter if he lies to his girlfriends, he is such a great leader. And when there's 200 people on stage and he has to, like, in that opening montage, kiss all those dancers goodbye and give them their hugs, and the way he treats them with such humanity, that's the difference to me between the theater and everything else. Like, mm-hmm. The theater is a tribe and everybody is in it together, and there's such a true sense of, like, we're all, you know, one for all and all for one. And I try and bring that into my world, even if I'm working on a, you know, really quick action-y, procedural-y thing. It's just like, I'm going to take a second with this day player and say, it's really hard what you're doing. It's hard to come in and be the waitress and do one line with a famous actor. That's very stressful. I'm aware of that. And I say, oh, you crushed it. Thank you so much. You know, now I'm like, I'm on schedule and you did great. And they just look at me like, oh, my God, we just had a moment of humanity here. And, you know, because they're mm-hmm. often so good and they're being thrown into these situations to do something that could seem small, but it's never small. Anybody who is authentic in front of a camera, to me, it's a huge achievement. And then to do what Roy Scheider does, where he can be so theatrical. I mean, Ben Vereen does at the end, too, like so theatrical and yet not over the top. And, you know, I worked as a secretary for Sidney Lumet when I was young. And one of the things I said, I'm going to go make my first film. What's your advice about acting, or what's your advice about all these things? And one of the things he said was, the idea that actors have to be whisper and be understated came from when they took Rita Hayworth off the bar stool at Traff's and made her a star. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like she was a model. So it was like, just keep it really down and blah, 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 blah. And now I see these movies like, I don't know, Divergent or whatever, and they're in the middle of a bombing and they're all talking like this. Hey, yes. Da, 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 da. And I'm just like, but there's bombs going off in the background. I think you'd be yelling and I think you'd be a little amped up. And so for me, the idea that underacting is for bad actors, but good actors can do anything. They can hit the high notes and the low notes and the loud or soft, and they won't be too big, you know. Yeah. And so you have to, you know, when I worked on House of Lies, Don Cheadle, he can be huge, but nobody ever says, oh, he's over the top. Well, why not? Because he's real.
Mm-hmm. I think about that in terms of just a recent performance, Toni Collette in Hereditary.
Oh, yes. So good.
Who goes, you know, just tits to the glass with her performance, but it's perfect.
Yeah.
It is perfect. It is every note is exactly. And that brings me to something that Scheider really enjoyed about working with Fosse on this movie, too. That they had both studied Stanislavski method. And so it was a lot of asking, you know, if Scheider's doing something in a scene, then Fosse comes up to him and says, hey, what's your as if? Right now.
Right.
And, you know, to explain as if it's, you know, kind of drawing.
It's as if my dad just told me that I'm not allowed to go to the party, or, you know, you'd give that to a teenager.
Yeah.
You know, you'd give, I mean, a young performer, but you have to come up with a substitution for what the character's stakes are, because often as a person, you can't relate to the character's stakes. Right. I've never been an alien that's getting my, you know, soul taken away, but I've lost my mother died and I can have, it's as if somebody's coming to tell me my mother's, you know, terminal or something. Those are the type of emotional work that actors use to ground the scene in their reality.
Yeah. And it's great that they were speaking the same language, though. Like, Scheider appreciated that if he wasn't getting something, like, the right emotion for Fosse, Fosse would just say, run through your as-ifs. Mm-hmm. And he would stop him at the right one and be like, that's the emotion that I want. And so they had a really great shorthand for that performance together. And I just appreciate that kind of work relationship where, you know, again, it's a director who appreciates the process of the actor because he was an actor, you know, himself. He was on the stage. Mm-hmm. He was doing the same things. Do you work in any similar ways when you're working with an actor? How do you get them to find the right emotion?
Absolutely. I mean, I never trained as an actor. I trained as an actor to become a director. I always wanted to be a director.
Yeah.
But that said, I did Stanislavski training and Meisner training and repetition exercises and all of that kind of work. So I can use language that is helpful with actors. And I also do a lot of like mentoring and I was just talking to a director who's doing his first episode. Actually, he's shooting this week. Good luck.
Oh.
But I was just trying because he was, you know, he's a cinematographer. And so the acting part was something that was concerning to him. And I said, they don't want a conversation. You know, this isn't about a conversation of, oh, and I understand like what, you know, butchers do and how mm-hmm. their work process. They want something active that's simple that can be communicated directly. And I think coming from dance, you know, it's a very sharp, almost military way of working. 5, 6, 7, 8. I mean, the one thing I had when I was working with some of the dancers as actors is that they can be so hard on themselves because when you're just asking for a different color, they're thinking, I did the steps wrong.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so you have to say, no, that was great. Let's try another version. You know what I mean? That this is not like, you know, what exactly do you want to do? Me to do is kind of they're a blank slate that they give themselves over to the choreographer.
Mm-hmm.
But also I think with Scheider, there's something about it not having been his type that we all get typecast on how we look.
Yes.
And Roy Scheider was not a leading man. He was not somebody that you'd necessarily look at and say crazy womanizer.
Yeah.
But maybe he wasn't his personal. I mean, I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, he's clearly got something there and he's got this real charisma and he knew he had it in him. So I think when an actor gets to do something where they're like, this is actually the real me, you know, and I always play these other parts, you know, the sheriff or whatever. But now I'm getting to thrive. I wonder if that helped him as well.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Scheider said that Fosse and him, after the movie was done shooting, they became friends. They hung out at least once, twice a week, every week.
Oh.
You know, and that's not something that generally happens. I mean, like,
right.
So you're hanging out with Parker Posey like once, twice a week
right.
for years, you know? That's like until the day he died, you know, they became good friends because
that's
I think
great.
Scheider could identify with these things.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you're also tapping into something, another part of this that I want to get into that we circled around, which is finding the honesty in a scene or a performance. Because, you know, again, one of the things that Fosse would ask anyone in the movie, Scheider, anyone, was, are you being honest right now? Are you being honest? And you would say it like in an earnest way. Like you just wanted to make sure, like, are you being honest to yourself? And more often than not, if he would ask that, then the actor would kind of rethink how they were approaching the scene because maybe they had lost their honesty, you know.
But you have to say it in a way that it doesn't crush the spirit, right?
Exactly.
Because to go up to an actor and say, are you being honest? There's a way to say that, which is like, I'm a terrible actor. I want to go in a hole and cry. And I just had two weeks ago, I walked up to a young kid and I said, I don't buy it. I whispered in his ear. I was like, I get what you're doing, but I'm not buying it at all because he's running from the law and his father just died and he was being very emotional. And I said, he just nodded and took it in. And then it was like, so let's get there like legitimately. Do you know what I mean? And I understood what he was doing. He understood what the scene needed. The scene needed him to be choking back tears. But we actually took a little time and we got to a place where it was almost a similar level, a little bit less, but it was real.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, thank you so much for taking the time. Thank you for walking me through it. And what made it real was also clarifying his intention and not playing a general I'm weepy or I'm upset, but playing a more specific I'm asking the question. I'm trying to get the answer. You need to get X, Y, or Z. You need to understand what happened with this or that. And I think you know, there's a wonderful blend with Fosse of cinematography and lighting. And again, as we're talking about the use of sound, all of the elements of filmmaking. But if it didn't have that honest performance underneath it, it wouldn't work.
No. I mean, that's the thing that buoys this whole thing.
Yeah.
I do think Fosse got away with talking to people a little bit harsher because he would say it with the smile and he was kind of like a cad, very
and
charming.
And he was a star also, so that gives you an extra.
Exactly,
you know.
Yeah. Like he would say to Scheider, come over and be like, are you sure that's how you want to do it? Because, you know, film is forever.
Yeah.
This is going to make history.
That's great.
And then Scheider would be like, shut the fuck up and leave me alone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So once more, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Exactly.
Go back to one.
Yeah. There is one thing that, like, Fosse also had a difficult time of translating from stage to screen, just process. Very few things. He understood most of it. But there was one where he was rehearsing the Everything is Old is New Again number. And that's between Kate and I can't remember the daughter's name.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I know her real name is Elizabeth Foldy.
Right.
I can't remember her. Anyway, they were rehearsing that number
where
they come down the stairs and they've got the top hats, and it's a really lovely scene and great choreography, and it's just really thoughtful, and they're trying to kind of perform their love for you know, this guy Joe. And so Scheider came in, watched the rehearsal, and just started weeping because he was like, he couldn't not see himself as Joe Gideon would see it. Mm-hmm. And he was just weeping, and then he told Fosse, he was like, never make me see a rehearsal again. He's like, because he's like, I have to wipe this entire memory away from me because I need to see it in a more honest manner in the scene. And
right.
So I need to be surprised by this. I don't want to know what this is. I want to have an
right.
honest emotional reaction. So you'll notice that the reaction in the movie is one where he's not crying. He's like, he's being Joe Gideon. He's keeping it in because he wouldn't weep. You know, that's
right.
not.
Right. Right. That's great. He also does. I love the fact that he uses, you know, the moment to get into Joe's head when they do the read through and he drops out all the sound.
Wonderful.
And everybody's laughing too hard. And to be able to depict with no dialogue, no words, no backstory, no exposition that this is not good. That this isn't the show isn't working, and how that feels for him, which leads up to him having his first heart attack.
Yeah, and he's rubbing his left hand.
Yeah.
He's like, he's feeling the numbness, you know.
And that it's very subjective, and you're very with him. And I think Fosse's not appreciated enough as a filmmaker, you know, because that's a Hitchcock move. But it's because the whole movie isn't done in a subjective Hitchcock style. I think it's in a weird way his versatility sort of makes him not stand out as much. Or I wonder, is it because musicals are less respected because they're less male? Go, April Wolf.
I mean, I think that he did not get his credit due. And I think that if you even talk to like Ellen Hine, like he was doing interviews not that long ago where he was saying if this were released now, I think that it would get a lot more credit than it did back then. There was, you know,
it's his Raging Bull. And even if you look at something like Star 80, there's some amazing photography in Star 80. There's a moment where this is the Marielle Hemingway movie where she plays the Playboy bunny who got murdered by her boyfriend.
Yeah. Which a lot of people hated.
Yeah. And it's considered bad. But I've looked at that movie and I love the filmmaking in that movie. There's a scene where the girls are all on roller skates going around, and the way they are shot like pieces of meat. And the lecherous guy's looking at them, and I feel like that's intentional. He is not making them pieces of meat. He is making us see how the men see them.
Mm-hmm.
It's very voyeuristic and very creepy.
Subjective point of view. He's just really, really good at dropping you into this person's life. And then we'll continue a little bit with that because we're going to talk about some of those last dance numbers and you know, the ending of this film, I think, is just gorgeous and beautiful. So one quick break and we'll be right back.
The secret is out. I, Open Mike Eagle, officially had a wrestling match. And on the next Tyson Fights, I'm talking all about it. From the rap battles that got us started.
Open Mike, you ain't man.
Oh, really?
You cold like some spaghetti.
And to how I hurt myself in ways I didn't know I could. That day and the day before, I got so many texts from people who really care about me who were like, please don't break your neck. The only place you can get the full story is on the newest episode of Tights and Fights. Find it on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm here today joined by Daisy von Schroeller-Mayer, and we are talking about All That Jazz. I've got to get into some of this end stuff because I think that this is where Fosse exhibits some of his greatest talents, which is blending the macabre with the dazzling and the mundane, you know? And this is like those three things that he can kind of like spin around and put into different places using the editing style. It's just wonderful. Specifically, I'm thinking about this in the hallucination sequences where the three women are performing these highly comic routines about death. So very, very funny costumes and everyone's smiling and happy, but it's all about death. It's, you know, it's so macabre. And I think it's probably definitely my sense of, it's my aesthetic. But I'm curious, you know, I feel like people would have potentially told him to pull back. I know that there are some things that they told him that they didn't want him to do. And he was just like, no, I'm just going to keep pushing on it.
Well, one thing I want to start with about that last 12-minute dream sequence, which is so stunning, is Phil Rosenberg, who's a wonderful production designer, did the movie and did all of Sidney Lumet's movies and was all about realism, shooting on location, being, you know, he did Serpico and all these movies about reality. But for that sequence, Fosse had Tony Walton, you know, theatrical designer, come in, and there's so much use of mirrors and layers of imagery behind something else, seeing through something, mm-hmm. and these great double images and sort of kaleidoscope effects, and even just the whiteness of the hospital, the way he shoots the hospital, crazy white, and then you go in and you have the white angel of death in those sequences. But the very end, it's such a tour de force, and it's almost like an opera in terms of all of our narrative is now in song and dance. Mm-hmm. And it's like the symbolism is almost too on the nose. I was thinking about him running into the house to say his goodbyes to everybody. And the sleazy producer's like, you're going to make some money off of this. And he's, you know, and then he hugs his daughter and I just want to cry. And I'm like, how can I want to cry about his relationship with his daughter in the middle of this completely absurd, you know, Pirandello, whatever you want to call it, like crazy number.
Yeah, everyone's laughing and singing. And it's one of those things where I think we should mention, you know, we'll talk about music. That's the last thing that we'll get into. So I'm going to skip that for right now. But I think that we should also talk a little bit about the lead up to that, too, which is, do you remember the scene with the chest spreader?
Yes, the bypass surgery, which Fosse had had.
Yeah, and that's it's an actual bypass that they're filming.
Right.
And it's fascinating the way that he chooses to depict that as well, because it's gross, it's disgusting. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you can't look away because he's intercutting that with very kind of wryly comic talk about insurance and how much money these people are going to make if he dies.
Right.
And it's hilarious. And at some point in time, you know, the camera dips in and starts looking at the wood grain of the table like it's getting too bored by the conversation. And as soon as you get comfortable with that, it's just like, oh, chest spreader. And you just see like a beating heart. And it's just, oh, like you can't look away from it.
And it draws the conclusion. These men who are talking about the insurance claim are also talking about this man's life.
Yeah.
And, you know, look at it. That's his heart. And we're being so dismissive of it. I mean, it's a great commentary without using words.
Yeah. There's a certain kind of callousness that we have in businesses like show business, you know, where you have life insurance policies on your biggest actor. You have life insurance policies on your biggest asset on a project because, you know, well, maybe they'll die. And then, you know, you got to make sure everyone recoups their money and all that kind of thing. And so there is a kind of inhumanity about it. And
There's also when the actresses are in those, they're in these like body suits which have veins on them, mm-hmm. and they're doing that final dance, and there's some that to me recalls that chest spreader scene, because mm-hmm. they are almost like pulsing parts of his heart. You know, they feel like blood, you know, clots or something in their skeletal and like skeletons. So like all this imagery, he's able to use very what we'd call, you know, in camera, like regular old costumes, special effects. Nothing's, I mean, my God, there's no VFX. There's none of that. Mm-hmm. And yet, boy, you feel like you're transported to a different universe.
Yeah. In your career, have you ever had points where you wanted to go that whole kitchen sink, like to the glass at the end, or like mm-hmm. just in, you know, like,
oh yeah, I mean, it was a big hit in England and India called The Guru, but we just did the craziest, silliest Bollywood numbers in the middle of a kind of regular romantic commentary, and to me it was great. It was like we were the movie was a romantic comedy, which was also making fun of romantic comedies, and the boy loved the movie Grease, and at the end of the movie we made he and Heather Graham do a Bollywood dance number, get into a car, and the car goes up into the air like the end of Grease.
Yeah.
And it's silly, you don't always get the accolades of Bob Fosse for your attempts at surreal theatricalism. So that movie, my agent said, you're now in Hollywood jail and we'll see if we can get you another job.
Oh, my God.
I know. But, you know, so but balls out. You got to do it. You got to do it. You got to sometimes go, you know. Go for it.
Daisy, I think you should send every car into space, into
exactly.
the air.
Exactly. The Grease, I was like, it's the ending of Grease. Come on, let's do it.
Look, if Elon Musk gets, like, applauded right. for sending an actual car into space, then, like, why can't you?
More cars into space.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that is the kind of thing that we need to talk about, where, like, do women get to take the kind of risks that Bob Fosse gets to take?
I'm just going to be really positive about women today, April. I feel like we are entering a new time, and
I believe that. I'm seeing it.
I'm feeling
at the theater.
It. But have we in the past? Probably not. Or have we gotten the? You know, when I look at some of my favorite films, people have never even heard of them. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like Smooth Talk, Joyce Chopra's movie. Like yep. I am often telling people about that film, and admittedly, it's old, but. You know, I feel like the guy version of that would still be recognized and known. You know, it's like The Sandlot or something.
Yeah.
Well, that's not a good example. Yeah. That. I was thinking of like coming of age films, but The Sandlot's actually a kid's film, more like River's Edge.
I mean, I hope that I do think that people are taking more chances, though, on women who do things that aren't just, you know, a very typical, quote unquote, woman movie or movies for women. Or,
right. And honestly, you know, I'm currently working within an existing television structure and really enjoying it and really enjoying working at places where I do feel the director is much more respected than the stereotype of the TV director. I feel like I do have artistic influence and in how things are lensed and how things are covered. And it's not the sort of factory, you know, like now that television mm-hmm. has become much more creative, we're also doing much more creative and interesting work. And it's led me into genres that I would never have gone into
yeah.
before, because it is a sort of for hire thing. So you end up following the people and situations you like, which has led me to doing zombie work and action much more than I would have expected. And I love it. And it's funny because action reminds me a lot of dance. And I've had a lot of dance in Party Girl,
yeah.
a lot of dance in all the films I've done. I've always come back to that as I'm not a dancer, but I love dance and I love dance on screen. And when you're figuring out how to shoot the dance number and you're figuring out how to shoot the car crash, it's a very similar process. You're bringing in other artists, you know, stunt people or choreographers. You're saying, this is the intention. This is the tone. This is the story we're telling. And then you're all coming together to figure out the safest and best way to depict that.
Yeah.
And it's very similar.
And what you're talking about also is just the collaborative nature
yes.
as opposed to, which, you know, again, in all that jazz, you see the collaborative nature of all of this, you know.
Yeah.
Fosse's the head, but there's like a ton of moving parts.
And he's so respectful of his of his collaborators. Like, he doesn't like that guy's song, but boy, he turns it into something great. The redhead, the songwriter.
Yeah.
And he really respects his wife, and he really respects his opinion. And he never thinks he's good enough. I think that's the other thing as a show business person that I appreciate about it, is his insecurity. And even at the end of the film, when he's going off with the orderlies are leading him away in the actual hospital, mm-hmm. and he's talking about cutting his movie.
You come along with us.
Nice and quiet now, please. Don't cause no trouble.
Everything's going to be fine, all right?
All right. So long, Tiger.
Later, Gideon.
This is just a rough cut, you know. I don't have the titles in yet. And the underscoring's not in. It's not really finished. I need more time.
And I'm like, oh, that's the metaphor for death, right? Like, it's the movie that we haven't finished that we just want one more pass at, you know?
Yeah.
Give me one more chance to just fix that one thing. It's such a deeply human experience. And he manages to show the similarities between, I think, you know, our lives and our work.
And that's one of the things that I think is also fascinating. It's a movie about the unfinished lives and the unfinished work. But this is a perfect film.
Mm.
It is extremely finished. You know,
right.
It is polished. There is every single thing about it is exactly as good as it can be. And I think about that in terms of, you know, like, polished to me is also specifically like the sound design, the music, you know, and the music of this is, you cannot get better. The opening number when they had 700 people on that cattle call is, it's fascinating in itself, you know, the way that Fosse directed it. They had 2 days in the Palace Theater.
Right.
And they knew that they were going to use On Broadway, even though they weren't dancing to On Broadway.
Right.
So then it turns out to be like a 6-minute, you know, music video, right?
Well, what's amazing is it starts out super documentary, but by the end of that sequence, he's doing these kind of Busby Berkeley shots where the dancers are relating to the lens and we're going, their hips are coming down the stage right into the camera. So in the course of that one number, he takes us from reality into choreography, into style, into mm-hmm. theater. And shows us, and that's what Joe Gideon does.
Yes.
It's like the number itself is a perfect kind of, this is who Joe is. He's the guy that takes regular people off the street, and by the time he's done with them, they're relating to the camera. I guess what I'm trying to say is it's about our relationship as an audience member to the movie, and he's always guiding that. Every mm-hmm. his framing, everything he's doing with the music and the sound and the light, it's all, you know, it's curating our experience and it's leading us. And I don't think you watch it feeling that.
Yeah.
The way you do. You know, you watch a horror movie, scary music, scary lighting. Oh, they're making me feel a certain way. He's making you feel a certain way every minute of that film, but he is not drawing attention to his craft.
Yeah. Alan Hynes said that he was one of the few stage people who came to film who directed for the frame.
Mm, yeah, exactly.
And it's a very difficult thing to do when you're used to a giant palette to try to narrow that down. But I love the fact that, you know, that musical number, Everything Old is New Again, to me represents everything about this movie, from the music to everything else. He's reinventing old things.
Right.
Things that have already been around and trying to mash them up and trying to make them the best that they can by pulling from different places. So you've
right.
got, you know, and that's the same thing. Like, On Broadway is a cover.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, it's a cover of a very old song and it's like hip and it lasts.
Right.
And then, you know, you got Everything Old is New Again that sounds like it could be written for today. Towards the end, you've got Bye Bye, My Love.
Yeah.
Goodbye.
Right.
The Everly Brothers. Sorry.
Right.
And it is the wryest interpretation mm-hmm. of a teen love song.
Yeah.
It is the wryest and most literal. And
right.
in that literalness becomes hilarious
right.
and sad.
But also dark and scary.
Exactly.
You know,
yeah.
when Ben Vereena has the dark glasses on and he says somebody, you know, not a great entertainer. He goes through his like spiel as a showman introducing that last number and introducing the music. He's critical, you know, and there's mm-hmm. and that to me is dramatizing you know, Roy Scheider's hatred of himself, like all the things he doesn't like about himself and all his insecurity. And then it kind of builds into this joyous number by the end where Ben Vereen is on his side and singing a duet with him. And I don't know. It's like how we can make a mark.
How do you use music in movies?
As much as I can. I love music. I feel like there's, I mean, beyond the musical, the course, you know, the perfect song for the perfect scene, which is great. But I also love score, and I love score that's helping tell the story, but not drawing attention to itself. And I feel like, as with what I was saying about acting, you know, you make everything understated. Or like right now, there's no music in the music anymore.
Yeah.
Like we now have just drones and tones. And I think a lot of that comes from the technology,
yeah,
that you don't have to read music to just do sound effects.
Yeah.
And it comes from a lot of bad music that was out there in movies and on television. And it made everybody say, oh, it's telling us how to feel. It's telling us how to feel. Don't use it. So most of the stuff I work on now, they say how much they hate music. And I'm like, that's too bad. Because,
yeah,
you know, Elmer Bernstein or whoever, like, there have been some people that were really telling you how to feel, and it was awesome, and it wasn't done badly.
Yeah.
And you didn't necessarily, or Rachel Portman or whoever, you know, it's my husband, David Carbonara, but you're not drawing attention to it. You know, it's underneath, and it comes in late and it leaves early and you don't even know it's there. And to me, you're manipulating the audience with the lighting, with the acting, with the sound. Why are you not allowed to use music? Because it's going to tell you how to feel. Everything's telling you how to feel.
People,
you know what I mean?
It's cheat.
Not, this is not like the Maisel brothers. We're not turning the camera on reality. This is we're stylizing everything. And even in the most fake, unstylized movies, they're stylized for that because that's a thing.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it's about that subtlety and about getting the audience in such an immersive experience that they're not noticed that they're being manipulated. And nobody's watching the opening number of All That Jazz and thinking, oh, it's a documentary. Wait, now it's a Busby Berkeley number. Like, they're just not noticing it. They're just getting into the music video of it, and it's sort of leading them through.
Yeah. That reminds me of a quote Larry Cohen, the filmmaker, said. He said, every movie is an exploitation movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Because he always got flack for making exploitation movies, and he was just like, you guys are lying to yourselves.
Yeah.
Every movie is an exploitation movie. You're exploiting something. You're, it is stylized, even if it's not stylized.
Right, or the other side. Yeah, my film professor at Wesleyan, Janine Basinger, she had a great line about, you know, everything's done for the box office. You think the art film about the pedophile priest isn't thinking about their audience? Like, everybody's thinking about their audience. Do you know what I mean? It's no one's really doing, unless you're really doing an experimental thing for MoMA. But even then, I think in the back of your mind, you're thinking of your MoMA.
What does MoMA think about
right,
this?
What are the true art critics from Art News or whatever? Like, on some level, we're always aware of the audience. I mean, that's why we're storytellers. If you didn't want an audience number, you know, you're in the woods clapping and whether or not you can be heard.
Well, that's a lovely place for us to end. And I want to thank you so much for coming
thanks
in
for having
and talking
all those
to
stories.
Me.
I it's my favorite film, and I don't think I knew half of what you researched, so that was awesome.
Well, thank you again.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it on air. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. Please check out our Facebook group. That's Facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.